I'm still agnostic. I don't know if there's God or there's not. And I don't think there's any way you can prove it one way or the other. But I do think that having reverence for some parts of life, for rituals, for family, that these are important. You can still find parts of religion that are beneficial to your life, even if you don't believe in God.
In this interview, I'm joined by AJ Jacobs. AJ is a four-time New York Times bestselling author, journalist, editor at Esquire magazine, and maybe one of the most interesting people alive today. His books include A Year of Living Biblically, which documents his attempt to follow every single rule from the Bible as literally as possible, including stoning adulterers, not shaving his beard, and only wearing white. The Know-It-All, which is all about reading the Encyclopedia Britannica from start to finish, as well as My Life as an Experiment, The Puzzler, and Drop Dead Healthy. In this conversation, we explore what AJ learned from 2 months of radical honesty, the value of boldness and the time he accused Oprah Winfrey of farting on set, the puzzler mindset and the importance of replacing motivated reasoning with curiosity, AJ's thoughts on what it takes to write a great book, and more. You can learn more about AJ's work and books by going to ajjacobs.com, and his latest book is The Year of Living Constitutionally, and it's released in May of this year. Okay, AJ, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So to get started, something I was curious to ask you is you've written books on such a wide range of topics. You know, you've written one on A Year of Living Biblically. You've written one on optimizing your health. You've written one on gratitude. You've written one on puzzles, just to name a few. But what would you say the central thread of these books are? Is there any kind of common pattern or underlying aim you've had with all these books, would you say?
Well, I'm a huge fan of experimentation. So I think that's one of the common themes. They're all about experimenting to see what works, to see what doesn't. And all of them have aspects that were disastrous and made my life miserable. But they also, all of them had aspects that I learned from and took away and made my life better and changed me for good. So that's one of the major themes.
And I've heard you say elsewhere that almost all of these books, in some sense, could be described as puzzles. And then you directly went at it with writing a book on, like, the puzzler, you know, so.
Right. Well, I love puzzles. I mean, I've always loved puzzles since I was a kid, you know, the crosswords and mazes and jigsaws and such. And what I love about them is they're all about curiosity and trying to solve a problem, as opposed, there's a great, I like a good rhyming phrase, Niall. So I love this phrase, don't get furious, get curious. Don't get furious, get curious. I first heard it when I was like listening to a psychologist talk about raising kids, but I apply it to everything. So I think that puzzles are more than just, you can take it beyond just crosswords and apply it to life, the puzzle of life. And it's all about being curious and trying to figure things out. So yes, you could say that all of my books are puzzles. So for instance, one puzzle was, how do I become more grateful? Because I was my default, as many people's, is the negative bias. I was very good at finding the things to complain about. The inner Larry David, I call it the struggle between the inner Larry David and the inner Mr. Rogers. I don't know if you have Mr. Rogers over there, but so the puzzle was, how do I become more grateful? And the answer was to go out and thank people myself in person or over the phone or on email and thank 1,000 of them for just a single cup of coffee. And that will drive home just how much goes right that we take for granted, as opposed to focusing on the things. So that was a good puzzle, and I did make some headway. I changed my perspective, and I'm much more grateful, and I try to thank people much more. So that's just one example, but they could all be framed as puzzles.
You seem to have a real talent. I don't know if you call it a talent or not, but for taking things to their absolute logical absurdities, you know? And you did this with A Year of Living Biblically as well. Can you maybe tell us about your mindset there and the value in this approach to life?
Sure. And thanks for calling it a talent instead of a weakness or a disease. But yes, I think that it's an interesting approach to push things to their limit. And then you can, that will reveal what works and what doesn't. So, for instance, you had mentioned that the first time you encountered my work was in Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. And that one, for that book, was actually an excerpt in an article I wrote called My Outsourced Life, where I decided, this was like 20 years ago, and I decided I was gonna, I read about outsourcing and how banks and law firms were doing it, but I'm just a writer. But I thought, I like this idea of having other people do the work that I don't want to do. What if I outsourced my life? So I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to do everything for me. And they did. They answered my emails. They answered my phone. They read bedtime stories to my kids. They argued with my wife for me. And it was awesome and absurd, as you say. But there were some things, as always, that you can take away. So I stopped doing it after a couple of months and started to live most of my life again. But there are things, at first, it taught me the value of delegating. Delegating, you're never going to get the exact same results if you delegate, but you will be much happier. And it also, one of the stranger ones, but I think that's that might be applicable to your audience, was I tried to outsource my worry. I was worrying a lot about a deadline, and I asked my outsourcer in India, I said, I know this sounds weird, but would you just worry for me for 15 minutes a day about, and it worked. It was very weird how that worked. Now, I don't really do that much anymore. Sometimes I'll trade worries with a friend, and you worry about my kid passing this exam, and I'll worry about whatever. But more often now, I try to contain my worry into a 15-minute worry time. I say, anytime I start to worry, I say, you know what? That's fine. I've got from 5 to 5:15, and I'm going to worry then. Let's not worry now, because worrying is a waste of time. Worrying, problem solving is great. I love problem solving, I'll do all day. But worrying, where you're just ruminating over it, that is not a good use of your time. So I just give myself that 15 minutes to worry, and that is a much more efficient. And I don't know if I would have come up with that solution without the outsourcing ridiculousness.
I think it's a possible therapeutic intervention, actually. There could be something there. Can you tell me about the influence of Nellie Bly and George Blimpton on your thinking and your approach to life?
Sure, those were two famous American journalists. Oh no. Yeah, Nellie Bly was American. They were two American journalists. Nellie Bly was very early. She was in the 1800s, and she was famous. She was sort of famous for being the first experiential journalist, or stunt journalist, some people call it, where she did things like when the book Around the World in 80 Days came out, it was a fictional book. She decided to try to actually do it and go around the world in 80 days, which was hard at the time. It was before planes. And she wrote about all of her stops, and she was very famous. George Plimpton also had a similar approach to life and writing. He was just a regular guy, but he convinced all these sports teams, professional sports teams, to let him play. So what was it like to be a quarterback in a professional game? What was it like to get hit by a heavyweight boxer? That one I have not done and don't plan to. But what I loved about them is what I mentioned before, the idea of curiosity, the idea of experience, eating your own dog food, I think sometimes they call it in Silicon Valley. So really getting to understand something, to really experience it. And that to me is the best way of learning, experiential learning.
Something that blew my mind about this lady, Nellie Bly, is that she actually checked herself into a mental asylum to see, to just to show how bad it actually was from the inside and then write about it. But that's just such a huge risk because you might not get out,
Oh
So
yeah. Plus this was the 1800s. It wasn't like, you know, now it would be a risk, but can you imagine back then? So she was fearless. She was really something. And she was a woman, and she, which was astounding. So at the time, it was, and Stimulaby is a very sexist profession. But yeah, I am always inspired by people who try things. And what I love about that is she was doing it not just to experience it, but to reform. So I do try in my books to do things that will hopefully make my life better and then transfer to the readers and make their lives better.
For sure. Something that comes up there whenever you say that is this, your book, It's All Relative. And you, I wanted to ask about that. Well, maybe you could give people just a brief intro to what that book was on, but then did this change how you felt about strangers in the world in a way? Did it change your worldview at all? Like just to realize that in some sense we're all a little bit related, like most people are cousins. Not everybody, but like,
oh no, everybody. My thesis is everybody. And that book, it was called It's All Relative. That came out about 8 years ago. And it started because I got a strange email from a reader who said, I've read your books and you should know I'm your 12th cousin. And I thought this guy was going to ask me to wire $10,000 to Nigeria. But instead, it turned out he was legit. And he's part of this group of scientists and researchers who are building a family tree that just boggles the mind. It's not a tree, it's a forest. And the idea is to connect not hundreds, but millions, tens of millions of people in the same family tree. And right now, using DNA and using sort of a wiki approach to collaboration, they have a family tree with 200 million people on it. So you can put in there almost any person like Barack Obama, and it'll tell you how you're related, sometimes through marriage. Like with Barack Obama, he's my third great aunt's fifth great uncle, seventh great nephew, something like that. But it is an astounding fact to see just how we're all connected. And it's something we know instinctively. You know, we're taught we're the human family. As a kid, we were taught about the human family. But now you can actually see this. And yes, I certainly it changed my worldview. And I hope the hope of the book was that it would change other people's to see that we, you know, try to treat people knowing that you are part of their family. And in Hawaii, I like their every culture has their own kinship terminology. Like they have different ways of splitting up the family. But I love the Hawaiian kinship terminology because pretty much everyone's a cousin. You've got your parents and then your siblings and everyone else is cuz. And I love that because it's technically true. Everyone is a cousin. In fact, I married my cousin. I found out through DNA testing that my wife and I are seventh cousins. I loved it. She was alarmed, but I told her, listen, it's just the way we're all related. So yes, the idea was hopefully when someone cuts you off in traffic, you start to get frustrated, annoyed, and then you remind yourself, you know what? We shared a great, 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 great grandpa. Let's remember that. And in honor of him, I'm not going to give them the finger.
For sure. I think this is something that, you know, as the research grows in this area, like this is something they should maybe be teaching kids in schools, because if you grew up with this knowledge that you're related to most people, you're going to be less influenced by propaganda that might get you to commit violence against other groups in society. You know, so such an important thing.
Absolutely. And there is evidence to back this up. I mean, there have been studies. In fact, it's relevant now because it was about the Israelis and the Palestinians, and when they showed them how closely they were related, when they showed two strangers that they were actually related, they treated each other more kindly in this negotiation ritual that they had set up in the experiment. So yeah, there is some evidence that this might work a little. It's not the only way to solve the world's problems, but it is a tool and one we should use more of.
And I heard that you I think you interviewed George H.W. Bush because of this, and Daniel Radcliffe as well, is that right? Because they were like your 10th or 11th cousins.
Exactly. I turned it into sort of the ultimate LinkedIn, you know, because part of my job is how do I get to people and how do I convince them to talk to me? And this turned out to be a very effective method. And your listeners should use it if they want before everyone else starts to use it. If you go on sites like genie.com, G-E-N-I.com, and get on this World Family Tree, you can figure out how you relate. So I emailed George H.W. Bush's chief of staff and said, I know he doesn't do many interviews, but I am his cousin. We're 14th cousins. Would you make an exception? And she's like, well, I guess if you're a cousin, I guess maybe so. So it actually did work at times.
I'm definitely going to use this. This is brilliant for like for me for getting speakers and guests for
the podcast. So, exactly. Yeah.
Thanks for the heads up. All right. So you've run hundreds of experiments in the past few decades. Are there any that you've picked up that have had such a positive impact on your life that you wish you maybe had of, you had have known about earlier? Anything, any habits that have really stuck with you that have had such a good effect?
Oh, well, tons. First of all, I enjoyed listening to your back episodes because I just found another experiment I want to do, which is to write letters to and from my future self. I love that. One of your guests talked about that. So thank you. I'm always on the lookout for new experiments. But yeah, so there's so many, I don't know where to start. One is just the idea of trying not to gossip for a week. That, you know, gossip is fun in the short term, but it's kind of poisonous as well. And it makes me see the world in a more negative and cynical way. So trying not to say anything negative about anyone for a week. I mean, there are exceptions. You can say negative things about Stalin, but in terms of your friends trying not to do that. Let me think, what are some other ones? Well, the one you mentioned before, the gratitude one. If I had known how much gratitude can affect your mood and your worldview, I would have been doing it a lot more. And the way to do it, I think, is just to force yourself to do it. So that's what this experiment in gratitude taught me, is I would wake up in a default annoyed mood and I would not feel like thanking anyone, but I would force myself to thank. I would act as if I would say, all right, I'm going to call this person whether I want to or not, and I'm going to thank them for having the warehouse where my coffee beans were stored. And once you start doing it, then your mind catches up with your behavior. And that's one of the big themes in all of my books, is how much your behavior affects your emotions, how much the outer affects the inner. So there's a great quote, I wish I had made it up, but it's by like a 19th century preacher of some sort, who said, it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than think your way into a new way of acting. So that's one. Let me just list off another couple because I feel like I didn't answer fully. I love talking to myself. That is a one that I, because I feel when I talk out loud, I say my thoughts out loud, I realize that many of them are so dumb and paranoid and idiotic that they are not worthy of my time. Whereas if I keep them inside in my mind, then they just keep going around. So I would have talked to myself more often. I love the power of micro goals. So things like, I do walk on the treadmill a lot, and sometimes I don't feel like it, but I say, you know what, I'm just going to get on for 10 seconds. And then if I don't feel like it, I'll get off. But once I get on, I've never gotten off. But somehow having that mini goal of just 10 seconds really helps to get through to that first level.
Amazing. Now, there's two things I want to share here about two things I'm grateful that I discovered through your work. The first is, so before Christmas, we were supposed to do our interview, and what I learned from you about gratitude, but also your like experimental approach to life, I sort of decided to do this 12 days of gratitude experiment, where I would reach out to one person per day that had a positive impact in my life, and just let them know all the different reasons why I was glad that I knew them and how they'd had that effect. And it led to me reconnecting with people that I hadn't spoken with in years. And it was just like, I think it gave them a bit of a lift as well. And it was just a really cool thing to do. So I owe you thanks for that. And the second thing as well, AJ, is I heard you say on another interview that a way that you've helped to sort of improve your decision-making in the present is that you've used an app to create an elderly version of yourself at 70 or 80, and you keep this close to your desk or whatever. I've done something similar in my own life as well. Like I do a weekly review, and then I've got a picture of myself at I don't know, I think it's 70, and I'm like, what can you do for a future now this week, whatever. So it's just top of mind when I'm planning my week that I want to do something for that person.
I love that. Can I go deeper on both of those just quickly? First, can you give us an example of someone you thanked? Because I just love those kinds of stories.
Specific things I said, or
just someone you'd like, was it a teacher? Was it a, an old boss? Was it, do you remember any of the people you reached out to?
One was probably my best friend from primary school, from the ages of probably from about the age of 4 to about 18, but we haven't been in touch in about properly in years, you know? And I just sent him a message I know we haven't been in touch forever, but I just want to let you know that you had such a big positive effect on my life growing up. And then just talk about our memories together and stuff and all the different things I admired about him, and that just I really wished he was doing well and everything. And he got back to me, and he was actually just about to have his first kid. So we reconnected that way as well. And
so nice. See, I even get secondhand happiness from hearing that story. It's just, and I love that. And then the second thing you said, I'm so glad you tried. When I did it, this was 10 years ago. Now they have much better apps where you can age yourself. So and see yourself. And I imagine now with AI, you can actually talk to your future self. I'm guessing you could find, an app where you, your future self says, keep me in mind, friend. I loved what the UCLA professor, who you interviewed in a previous, people should check out that episode. And it's all about the future self. He had written a book about it. And one of his points, which I think is great, is treat your future self like a friend. Don't treat him like a stranger. Treat him. So when you're making decisions about, should I get off the couch or should I have another, Twinkie, then think what would my friend AJ at 70 want me to do? As opposed to what with this strange guy. So I like that as a way of framing. Be kind to your future self because he's your friend or she's your friend.
For sure. Can you tell me about the value of boldness? And maybe here you could tell me about the time you accused Oprah Winfrey of farting.
Well, thank you for remembering that. Yes, I told that story on a storytelling podcast. And just quickly, if I can recall it, I was on the Oprah Winfrey show for one of my first books. And the book was about trying to learn everything in the world by reading the Encyclopedia Britannica when that was still a thing. So this was right when Wikipedia was starting. Now you can't read Wikipedia because they are adding more now every moment than you can possibly read. But I could read the encyclopedia. It took a year and a half. It was 44 million words, but I did it. So anyway, I went on the Oprah Winfrey show to talk about that. And before the show, she had had a little Q&A with the audience where they asked her weird questions. And one person asked her, and this was not for air, but just one asked her, do you ever fart while you're doing your show? And Oprah Winfrey said, sometimes I do, but I always hum a little tune to cover it up. So I was on the show, and my first segment, she was interviewing me, but she was not loving it. I could tell she's a little cold. We were not vibing. We were not clicking. Then during the commercial break, I heard She was sitting across from me. We weren't talking because we weren't clicking. And she was humming. She was humming a tune. And I was like, I said to myself, should I do this? Like, should I make a joke, a fart joke at Oprah Winfrey's expense, the most powerful woman in media? And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try it because things are not going well now. So I said, I pretended to smell something, even though I didn't. I pretended to smell her fart and I waved my hand in front of my nose and I said, "Woo, Oprah, that was a stinker," something like that. And she paused and then she got and then she laughed and we were bonded. It was like a 180. And it was, she kept me on. The next segment went great. And she kept me on for two additional segments that weren't planned. And it was because I took this risk. Now, I don't say always take the risk. You know, I'd be, you know, you've got to weigh the pros and cons. But sometimes there really is value in diving in and doing something that it might work, it might not. But failure is part of life. If it had failed, what's the big deal? I mean, it wasn't going great anyway. But it happened to have worked and it changed everything. So yes, be bold. And again, it was, I was acting as if I were courageous. I did not feel bold. I did not be like, oh, I'm so confident that I can make this joke at this powerful person's expense. Instead, I just said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pretend that I'm feeling confident and I'm just going to do it. And I did it and it worked out.
It seems to be a great way to pattern interrupt. Like there's just something like there'll be like mental patterns going on in Oprah's mind or whatever. And then whenever you do that, it totally shifts her out of her usual frame. And she's like, okay, this is novel. This is interesting. And then she behaves totally different, you know? So I think that was genius.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it did work that time. And I like the way you frame it, a pattern interrupt. Yeah, sometimes people, if you just step back, I do sometimes like to do that. Like if an interview is going awkwardly, I'll be like, man, this is not going well, or something like that. Calling attention, leaning into the awkwardness and say, you know, and sometimes that works. Sometimes that works. This interview, I think, is going great, except for the freaking jackhammer outside my window. I'm hoping you and your listeners cannot hear it. Can you?
I can't hear it, so don't worry.
Oh,
I think we're
good.
Fine.
It is like loud. It's like in my temple. But other than that, this, I think, is a delightful conversation.
For sure. Now, you obviously live a very experimental life, but it must be, whenever you're deciding on which books to write and which experiments to run, you know, those are big decisions because these are things you're going to be investing years of your life into. So What I was curious to ask you is, like, how do you decide? Like, what are your criteria for books to write and what not to write? And I know you abandoned the book as well. It was on the post-truth crisis or whatever. So, like,
exactly, yeah.
How do you decide?
Well, I mean, part of it is just passion, what I'm most passionate about. But I'm also trying to get inside the mind of the reader. What would readers want to read about? So that I love tackling huge topics. So with my Bible book, I tackled religion. With health, I tackled health. Gratitude was mental health. And I did bite off more than I can chew with the truth book because it just turned out to be too sprawling. But the replacement was the book about puzzles. And I'm so passionate about puzzles, and I knew that I could. I also try to figure out before I embark on a book, what is the journey going to look like, and how is the book going to be structured? So with that one, the puzzle book, I knew that I would be able to put in puzzles into the book, so it would be fun for the reader. And I knew I wanted to hide a couple of puzzles in the book, like secret codes, when the first person to find it would win an actual cash prize, which has already been won. I'm sorry. So don't buy the book for that reason, but it's still in there and hopefully fun. So yes, trying to figure out sort of the algorithm of what I'm passionate about, what readers will be passionate about, what interesting structure can I attach to it, and how will it affect my life? And also, my wife has veto power. So For instance, I often get readers who give me suggestions, and a common theme of the suggestions has been like, why don't you try all the positions in the Kama Sutra and try to be like the best? And I did bring this up to my wife once, and she said, absolutely not. And I have to agree. I mean, maybe when I was younger, that might have been appealing, but it just sounds exhausting. So I leave that to you or to any of your listeners who want to try that experiment. I would support it from afar.
Yeah, we'll just, if anybody wants to do that one, send us an email and we'll publish the results or whatever, but I'll not bother. I've heard you say, AJ, that you read an article in The Atlantic about your worldview as a reverent agnostic. Can you tell us what this, you know, what this worldview involves and how this has affected your life as well?
Sure. That came out because of the book called The Year of Living Biblically. And just to give you quick background, that book I wrote because I grew up with no religion at all. I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So not very. But I had a son at the time who had just been born, and I wanted to figure out what should I teach him about religion, about the Bible and my tradition. So I thought one way to approach this would be to follow the rules of the Bible as literally as possible, to walk in the footsteps of the forefathers from 2,000 years ago. So I did. I followed the Ten Commandments, but then, especially in the Old Testament, there are hundreds of rules that don't get a lot of play. So I did the no lying, no coveting stuff, but I also tried to. The Bible says you cannot shave the corners of your beard. I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow, and I looked like I had this, you know, huge topiary on my chin. The Bible, Leviticus, says you cannot wear clothes made of two different kinds of fabrics. So I had to go through my closet and get rid of anything that was a blended poly cotton blend. So there were all sorts of things to do. And in the end, I had many takeaways, one of which was gratitude. I am still not a believer in God. I found there were parts of religion that really resonated with me. There were the community, getting together with a community, doing good, this idea of trying to make the world better, and rituals. I think there are some lovely parts of rituals. So, you know, the Jewish people have this annual Passover, where you just basically get around and eat and tell the story, which I'm not sure is true. I don't think it is actually technically true, but it's a lovely story about liberation and those kinds of things I like. So I guess my point with the phrase reverent agnostic was, I'm still agnostic. I don't know if there's a God or there's not. And I don't think there's any way you can prove it one way or the other. But I do think that having reverence for some parts of life, for rituals, for family, that these are important. And so that's where I've come out. sorry. That's where I've come out, that it is, you can still find parts of religion that are beneficial to your life, even if you don't believe in God. And there are people who are who are much more secular, who are trying to adopt this mindset. There was a great book by Carl Sagan's daughter, actually, about how, and I think she had a similar background. She's Jewish, but not practicing at all. But she says, how can we involve rituals in our lives to make them meaningful, but not necessarily accept all of the supernatural that goes with it? And I love that. I love that, because rituals really are important.
For sure. For sure.
Sorry.
What effect did wearing white all the time have on your psychology?
Well, that was a weird one, because the Bible, and this no one really pays attention to, but in Ecclesiastes, it says, your garments should always be white. Like, it's right there. And Most people take it metaphorically, but I said, if I'm living literally, I got to take it literally. So all of my clothes were white, and I had white pants and a white shirt. I looked like I was playing Wimbledon in like the 1920s. And eventually I went to a robe for part of it. And as I mentioned earlier, the outer affects the inner. It's a very powerful idea. And what you wear actually does affect your mind. And so weirdly, when I was wearing white, I felt different. I felt more pure. I felt cleaner. I felt, and I love that. And I used to have all dark hues in my wardrobe, and I've now brightened it up with all different colors. And I think it makes a difference. And there's a lot of science to back this up about how what you wear affects your mind. How wearing a uniform, for instance, has a huge effect on whether you obey authority. And it doesn't just affect your own mind. It affects how other people treat you. So when other people saw me wearing white, they were like, "Oh, that's interesting. Maybe he has some spirituality that I don't know about. So I better treat him with a little reverence or with contempt." It could go either way. I did read recently the writer Tom Wolfe is a famous writer in the 60s, 70s, and he wrote a famous book where he traveled with Ken Kesey and all of these people experimenting with LSD in the very beginning of that era. And he wore a white suit, a fancy white suit, and he liked it because he felt it set him apart. And they realized, oh, this guy, he's not one of us. He's here to observe us. I'm going to, you know, if I have anything to say, I'm going to talk to him. I prefer actually to blend in when I'm doing my reporting. I don't like to stand out. But it was interesting that he chose that route.
Yeah, I might try just buying some more white clothes to see what that's actually like. Now, can you tell me about the work of Brad Blanton, and what was it like to be just 100% honest? Was it a full month you did it? Like, what was that like to do
that?
A
couple of months, yeah. Well, this one came about because I found this. This was like, this again was a while ago, maybe 20 years ago. And I found out about a movement called Radical Honesty. And Radical Honesty was started by this psychologist named Brad Blanton. And he believes that you should never lie. You will live a better, more authentic life if you never lie. But he goes further than your average. He says that there should be no filter between your brain and your mouth, that like withholding something is lying. So if you notice that someone looks fat in that dress, you should say, "Oh, you look fat in that dress." And that will yield awkward moments, but in the end, it will be a better life because everyone knows you're telling the truth, and maybe that person will wear a different dress. Now, I thought this is interesting. I thought this in some way sounds like the worst idea I've ever heard, because the world runs on, we need some lies, you know, otherwise men would be sexually harassing women all the time. And you know, you would be fired from your job for saying, you know, "I hate my boss." So I was like, but I'm going to try it. Maybe there's something to it. And I will say, I tried it and it was horrible in many, many, many ways. But there was also always, as always, some good takeaways. So I'll give you the horrible and then I'll give you the good. So the horrible was things like, you know, running into a friend of my wife's at a restaurant and like a childhood friend and them saying, "Oh, we should all get together." And I would say, have to say things like, "Well, you seem nice, but I have no interest in ever seeing you again. Because I don't have the time. I don't have time to see my real friends. So I have no interest." And that, they were insulted. I felt like a horrible person. My wife was furious. No need to do that kind of radical honesty. But there is radical positive honesty. And that kind of what you did with your thankfulness project, I think counts as radical positive honesty. Is, even though it's a little awkward, reaching out to someone saying how much they meant to you, that is lovely. And even sometimes sort of, I wouldn't say positive or negative, but sort of neutral honesty definitely led to some breakthroughs. I remember I was having lunch with a friend and I said, I just want to say I love you. And there's one thing in our relationship that bothers me is that you never invited me to your wedding. And he said, well, you didn't invite me to your wedding. And I'm like, what? That's not true. And then it turned out it was true. I forgot to invite him to my wedding. So it was on me. But that now that little black mark, that little, complaint I have is gone. It's gone because I realize what happened. So that was another positive. So there are positives, ways to use on radical honesty in a good way. You know, use radical honesty for good, not for ill.
Yeah, definitely. Double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly.
So this podcast primarily focuses on psychology and things like behavior change and stuff as well. So can you maybe tell us about how you gave up dried mangoes?
Oh, sure. That I was just thinking about that the other day. Well, I had read there was some research by I believe it was a Yale scientist who had said that one way to change your future behavior was to make a pact with yourself to say, and you could do this in positive or negative. You could say, you know, if I don't eat candy for a week, I will reward myself by going to a movie, you know, so you sort of make a pact. But you can do it the other way too. You can blackmail yourself. You can say, if I don't do something, if I do something naughty that I don't want to do, then I will punish myself. And one way to punish yourself is to, he came up with this, is write a check to a charity that you hate. Write a check. So I wrote a $100 check to the American Nazi Party. And I said to my wife, and I said, I'm serious about this. If I eat another dried mango, I want you to deposit this check to the Nazi Party. Now, dried mango may not sound like the worst, but really, it is just candy. It's like they've drained out the nutrients, so it's just a pure hit of sugar. It's just candy disguised as healthy food. So I was getting fat. I was like, I don't want to eat another mango, dried mango. So with this check looming over me, it worked. There was no way I was going to eat a dried mango because I was so appalled and revolted by the idea that the American Nazi Party would get $100 from me. And it was incredibly effective. So I think there are websites and apps now where you can do this, where you pledge to punish yourself, you blackmail yourself basically into doing what you want. I don't use it all that much. I'm more of a carrot guy now than a stick guy, but the stick is incredibly effective as a way to modify behavior.
Yeah, I'm the same. I would be much more carrot inclined now, but in the past I used to procrastinate a lot more. And whenever I was actually starting the company that the Weekend University now is, I actually used a site called stick.com. So STICKK.com. And I put like £500 against, it was like going to some charity. It was like pro George Bush library or something. I don't know what it was, but it was going to that charity if I didn't organize the first event by a certain date. And
I love it.
There's nothing more motivating than that, you know, like it really does work if you're sort of procrastinating on something.
Absolutely. And that is the website that was started by this Yale professor who came up with this idea. So yes, I think it's still around.
So now I want to quickly ask you about the puzzler, AJ. You mentioned, I think, the quote from Quincy Jones earlier, I don't have problems, I have puzzles. What's the kind of, can you maybe tell us about the puzzler mindset and how this, the benefits of this and how this kind of contrasts with things like motivated reasoning and why this is such an important way to look at the world, to have this mindset?
Yes, I love this idea of the puzzler mindset. And the one you quoted, Quincy Jones, as you say, he says, I don't have problems, I have puzzles. That's his life philosophy. And I think that's great because problems are very negative. They're intimidating. They're stressful. Whereas puzzles are, they are solution oriented. They even have a tinge of fun about them. So seeing whatever it is, seeing your career, getting your next job as a puzzle, seeing like, how can I make my marriage better? That's a puzzle. How can I get my kids to do this thing they don't want to do? That's a puzzle. It's almost like gamifying life. And I love it because I use it all the time. And it's become very handy, especially in these times which are so divided. So one example of the puzzle mindset that really comes in handy is when I'm talking to someone from the other side of the political spectrum, or just someone who has completely different views, then instead of trying to see it as a competition, which is my default. My default is I'm going to beat this person. I'm going to cite some statistics and I'm going to just crush them in debate. That never works. That or rarely works. They polarize. You both get angry and you entrench. Instead, I try to see it as a puzzle. I say, let's figure out together, almost like a cooperative adventure. Why do we disagree so much? What is it? What fundamentally do we disagree on? That's a puzzle. What evidence is there that could change your mind or could change my mind if there was evidence that said something different? If we're not able to change our minds, the puzzle is, where do we go from here? Is there anything productive we can do? Even though we don't agree on that, I'm sure we agree on many other things. So what can we do that is productive going forward? So all of these things, it's a much healthier way to have a conversation. So in the end, instead of feeling anger and recrimination, I feel like, well, that was an interesting conversation. We made some progress. I have a little hope. Let's see what happens. And it's just a much healthier way to go through life, I find.
It's so that reminds me of what you said earlier about don't get furious, get curious. Like, that's such exactly. A great mantra just to keep in your mind, you know? And these reframes are like, they're so simple, but they're so powerful. I interviewed a psychologist one time who specialized in an approach called motivational interviewing. And one of the things that he shared is that anytime he's working with someone, his frame is always, this is the most interesting person in the world, right?
Oh.
And that's his basic, like, if this person was the most interesting person in the world, how would I act? What would I ask? And things like that there. And I think if you have that frame, it's going to make every interaction so much more interesting than just not having it, you know?
For sure. I agree 100%. I mean, frames are so important. I'll give you two examples of framing that I love. One is a study where they had the classic prisoner's dilemma, where, you know, two people have to agree for a certain outcome. And people acted differently depending on what you called the game. So if you called it the Wall Street game, or, like, you know, the Wall Street competitive game, then people were much less likely to cooperate. But if you called it the cooperative game, then people were more likely. So I love that. There's another study I read, which I thought was brilliant, was people were given a certain odor to smell, and people interpreted it differently depending on what you said that odor was. So if you told them the odor was, what's that kind of cheese? It's a very sharp cheese sometimes used in, now I can't remember, Parmesan. I think it was Parmesan. Yes, it was Parmesan. If you told them it was Parmesan, they're like, oh, that's a nice smell. And of course, if you told them it was vomit, then they were repulsed. But those two smells are actually very closely linked chemically. So it all was how you frame it is how they reacted. So frames, as you say, so important.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Something else I wanted to ask you about is, so puzzles are essentially tools for helping us to develop our lateral thinking and other like thinking strategies. And I've heard you say that solving the little puzzles helps you solve the bigger puzzles in life as well. And there's something in psychology called psychological flexibility. And the whole idea here is that it's not really what you think or feel that counts. It's how you relate to how you think and what you think and what you feel. And it's all about being able to shift perspective and see from different points of view and everything else as well. And whenever I hear you speak about puzzles, it really strikes me that they could potentially be a therapeutic intervention for actually helping people to think more flexibly about their problems and things. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think there's anything there?
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I have two thoughts. One is I love the idea of trying to frame my inner psychology as a puzzle. Like, you know, I'm depressed. Why am I depressed? And trying to be curious about it. So you sort of put a layer between you and the depression. I like that. And then, like you say, I am such a huge fan of flexible thinking, because I think I fight it every day. We get stuck in these mental ruts, these neural ruts, and our go-to is always to think about a problem the same way. But all of the great, not all, I shouldn't say that, I should say, but I would say so many great ideas, so many great solutions come when you think flexibly. The cliche is to think outside the box. I feel okay using the cliche because it actually comes from a puzzle. The puzzle was these 9 dots in a square. How do you link them using only 4 lines? And the only way to do it was to go outside of the box. So draw a long line. So yes, flexible thinking. And my next book is about the Constitution. And one of my favorite founding fathers was Ben Franklin, and he said he was a huge fan of flexible thinking and epistemic humility. And he said, the longer I live, the less sure I am of the rightness of my opinions. And I love that. If we can all keep that in mind, then I think the world would be such a better place.
Definitely, definitely. And just to give people an example of an interesting puzzle, can you tell us about Gauss? I don't know if I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but Gauss, the 9-year-old who was given this mathematics puzzle. It was like different ways to...
Oh yeah, no, I know what you mean. Yes, this was it's a famous story, probably has some seed of truth to it, but this is one of the most famous mathematicians, I believe in the 1800s, I think he was German, and he was at school, and the teacher said, I guess the teacher didn't want to work too hard. So he said to the class, all right, everyone add up the numbers between 1 and 100. And then he thought he could just kick back and relax for the rest of the class. But instead, 10 seconds later, Gauss, the young 9-year-old Gauss, raises his arm and says, well, I got the answer. And the teacher was incredulous. He said, what, you cheated? I don't understand. And no, Gauss had done the answer. It's just he had thought about the problem before and said, what is the best way to solve this problem? The default is just to do what I would do, which is to add 1 + 2 + 3. So you get to 3, then add 3 is 6, then you add 4 is 10. That is going to take you a while. But he said, you know what? There's another way to look at this problem. I realize if you're adding 1 to 100, if you take the outside, if you take the 1 and the 100 and you add them together, you get 101. And then you do it 2 and 99. You also get 101. So why should I bother with adding all of them up? Instead, let's pair them off. So you've got 50 pairs that equal 101. So what would that be? 5,050. If you add 50 times 100 is, I believe, 5,050. I could be wrong. And so 10 seconds later, he raises his hand. And I love that, because before diving into the mini grind, he took a step back and it's like, is there another way to do this? Maybe there is an easier way. And he was right.
Yeah, I think it's such a great example just about the power of this way of thinking about the world. And just a couple more questions now to finish up, AJ. So I'm currently writing my first book, and
great.
You've done this prolifically for decades now. So I just wanted to ask, any general advice on writing a great book? I know that's a terrible question, but any complementary skills that maybe aspiring writers should develop in addition to writing and storytelling? Anything come to mind whenever I ask that question?
Well, interesting. I'll give you a couple of strategies that work for me, and maybe they work for you. One is certainly the idea of breaking it down. I try not to think, oh, I'm going to write a book. Instead, I'm going to write a series of chapters, and then at the end, I'm going to try to link them together and go back and thematically link them and narratively link them. But I find that much less intimidating than saying, oh, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to say, I'm going to write these series of stories and then connect them. Another one I have is just the idea of blocking off time. I mean, if you have that, for this last book, I went on the Ben Franklin schedule, which was I woke up at 5 a.m. and I wrote like until noon every day. And that was the only way I could get it done. Another skill I find is I am a big fan of sort of the, I guess you'd call it focus grouping almost. So I will send what I've written to 10 friends and I'll say, What do you find? Tell me which parts specifically you find most interesting and which parts you find least interesting. And if 7 of them say, well, this part was a little slow, then I know I've got a problem. But I like to do it with more than one person because one person could be an outlier.
Do you send the whole book when you're doing that, or chapter by chapter?
Sometimes chapter, like with this one, I sent out the first quarter of the book to friends and said, which parts are working for you? Because I wanted to know before I kept going what direction to was working.
Cool. Okay. Now that's great advice. So your new book comes out. I think it's called The Year of Living Constitutionally. That comes out in May of this year. Is that right?
Exactly. May 7th. I'm very excited.
And what do you hope people get from reading this book? What were your aims in writing it?
Well, I'm very excited. I'm not allowed to talk about it too much because the publisher will be angry at me. But the idea is basically it's a follow-up to The Year of Living Biblically. And in this one, I try to understand the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, by following it as literally as possible, trying to express my rights using the tools and mindset of our founding fathers. So for instance, I walked around New York with a musket, because that's my Second Amendment right, is carrying a bearing arms. For my first minute, I wrote pamphlets. Instead of going on Twitter or X, I wrote pamphlets with a quill pen and I handed them out. And I guess there are two parts to the book. One is the idea of how flexible should we be when we're interpreting the Constitution, which is a very big issue and the one that affects the Supreme Court decisions on every part of our life. And then the second part is, are there any values, anything from the 1700s that are worth reclaiming? There's a lot that was terrible. It was a sexist, racist, horrible time in many, many ways. But it was also, they were slower thinkers because they were writing instead of texting. They only read the newspaper. It came out 2 or 3 times a week instead of 18 hours of negative news in my face all the time. And there's a huge advantage to that. There is more of a stress on the common good, on virtue. All of these things I found changed my life for the better. We don't have to go back to the horrible sexist, racist times, but there are some lessons that are very, I think, urgent for us right now.
For sure, for sure. Well, I can't wait to read it whenever it comes out. And if you're looking to promote it, I'd love to share it with our audience. Well, if you want to do another interview sometime in the future, it could be fun.
Oh, listen, I'd be delighted to come back. I have plenty to talk about there.
Okay, well, I'll let you go, AJ. I just want to say thank you so much. I think 3 words that really come to mind whenever I'm thinking about AJ Jacobs would definitely be gratitude, curiosity, and experimentation. Those are kind of the 3 things that I really say that you embody, you know. So that's really 3 powerful things to
well,
put that into the word.
I have extreme gratitude for that, because those 3 are some of my favorite ideas, concepts, feelings. So thank you for all that you do and for having me on. I had a great time.
My pleasure. All the best, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Niall.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our mastered library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.